We are talking today with Dr. Sherry Speed. Dr. Sherry Speed lived in Cameroon full-time from 1998 to late 2011. During that time, she collaborated with the Cameroon government to found the Sanaga Yong Chimpanzee Rescue Center, a forested home for orphans of the illegal ape meat trade, while she led conservation programs aimed at saving chimpanzees and gorillas from extinction. With Edmund Stone, she established In Defense of Animals Africa as the U.S. base of support for the work in Cameroon. Currently splitting her time between Cameroon and the United States, she serves as director of IDA Africa and the Sanaga Yong Chimpanzee Rescue Center. And she is here to talk about her work and her new book, Kindred Beings, What 73 Chimpanzees Taught Me About Life, Love, and Connection. Sherry, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
I'm very happy to be here.
So start out, tell us, what was your motivation in writing your book, Kindred Beings?
Well, back in 1997, I had gone to Cameroon to work as a veterinarian with some chimpanzees, gorillas, and monkeys in an existing wildlife center there. And while I was there, I was volunteering only for a month. In January of 97, went back later the same year, and I met chimpanzees living in really deplorable conditions as tourist attractions at a hotel. And later, I met some others and got really connected to the conservation issues surrounding the great apes in the country and in all of Central Africa, and especially emotionally connected to these chimpanzees. And I just couldn't forget about them in those conditions, and ultimately realized that if I wasn't going to change their lives, then no one was going to do it. So I did change my life in order to change theirs. I moved to Africa. I collaborated with the government and with colleagues to build the sanctuary in the Mbarge Forest, and I freed these chimps from their chains and cages and gave them back a piece of their natural habitat. And that, in the process of that, I met some and befriended some chimpanzees who just profoundly impacted my life and thought that their story was worth telling. And so that is what Kindred Beings is.
So was the government of Cameroon cooperative in your efforts?
Well, the government of Cameroon, it is completely illegal to, first I'll say, it's completely illegal to kill, capture, eat, or hold captive chimpanzees and gorillas and other endangered species in Cameroon. But the government didn't have any way to enforce its laws when it came to chimpanzees being held captive because they had no place to take them. And so when we went there and set up the sanctuary, we enable them to enforce their laws, and then we provided the technical and logistical assistance for confiscations of adult chimpanzees. And I have a protocol agreement with the government that said their obligation is to act on illegal activity that I bring to their attention. So and you can't work in Cameroon without collaborating with the government. So in that, you know, they are cooperative. They don't give us funding, but they are cooperative.
So where do you get your funding from?
Well, from donations and some foundation grants. But it is, we have right now in the Mbarge Forest, we have 73 chimpanzees. It's very expensive to care for them, and I have a lot of conservation programs that are limited by the money that we can bring. So it's, but we are funded by donations around the world, but mostly here in the United States.
Do you have websites where people can
I
donate?
Do, thank you. It's www.ida-africa.org. People can read more about the work and make donations if they'd like and sponsor individual chimpanzees. And that's a very helpful way to support the work, and people can identify with individual chimpanzees and really follow their lives. And people really enjoy doing that. And then, you know, I think in reading my book, Kindred Beings, which is a memoir, actually I wanted to write about the chimpanzees, and the publisher, HarperCollins, wanted a memoir. So I wrote something that's sort of in between. But I think that it is a book that conveys my sentiment toward the chimpanzees and tells a lot about the work that we do. And for people who want to learn more, I think it's a good place to start.
So you were there a month and then you come back. Did you know that you wanted to create a rescue center?
Well, what I knew is in the beginning, I'm an activist at heart. I had sold my veterinary practice in 1995 and was working as an activist here in the United States. And I wanted to work as an activist to change this bushmeat situation in Cameroon. And so I had envisioned starting a small sanctuary in the forest and taking my friends, these adult captives who had been on chains and in cages for decades, I was going to take them back to the forest, and then I was going to work on wrapping up this bushmeat problem in a few years. Very naive about the scope of the problem. And as soon as I had any infrastructure there in the Embargé Forest, then you know, the orphans just kept coming and coming. And now that it is a big endeavor to care for 73 chimpanzees in the forest. And it was a, you know, I had no idea the scope of the difficulty of creating a sanctuary and operating a sanctuary in a country as difficult as Cameroon. But that does take a lot of our resources. And I have some great people working with me there. I have a French woman who's worked with me for 10 years and she's managing there now. And I have a good national workforce. I have about 22 nationals who work there full time.
So how big is the bushmeat industry in Cameroon?
Well, it's quite big. And just to give people some background on it, people in that part of Africa have lived close to the forest for millennia, and they ate what they could. They gathered from the forest. They killed animals from the forest, mostly with small traps. And then the colonizers back in the starting in the 1700s and the 1800s and 1900s brought guns. And so it became easier to kill large mammals. And so they started eating more chimpanzees and gorillas in the villages. But then in the last 60 years or so, there's been, as the human population has exploded, people have urbanized, and there's still a lot of people live close to the forest, but there's also a congregation of people in the cities, and they've taken their taste and tradition for eating bushmeat, which are any animals that come from the forest, they've taken that with them into the cities and then created a commercial trade that is really rendering the forest of Central Africa silent. It's not sustainable in any way. And while it's cheap to eat animals from the forest when you live in the village, and by the time it's killed in the forest, transported and then sold in the market, and everybody takes their cut along the way, it's expensive. It's more expensive than chicken or cow or goat. And so it's not, the commercial bushmeat trade is not about poor people eating what they have to survive. It's about people with a little more money to eat the food that they prefer, and they're feeding creating the demand that's feeding this trade. And then when it comes to chimpanzees and gorillas especially, they're large and slow moving and particularly vulnerable to hunters with shotguns. And they only produce babies every 4.5 to 5 years. And so their populations are really vulnerable to the hunting. And as their numbers have gotten low, their meat has gotten really expensive. And so now it's especially considered a delicacy, and it's a way for the affluent people to honor their guest and to show that they have money.
So your efforts are going up against a fairly powerful and entrenched industry, it sounds like.
It is. It's again, it's fed the commercial trade, and that's what we're really targeting, is the commercial trade. And right now we're targeting specifically that trade in gorillas and chimpanzees. And of course, there's a lot of injustice with the trade in general. And you know, we'd love to have a bigger impact, but we are not targeting the bushmeat trade. I mean, the eating of bushmeat in the village communities right now, but just the commercial trade. And it is big, and there's a lot of the meat that's sold outside of the country too, in Europe and the United States, and most of that is going to the immigrant populations in these other countries.
So, talk about when you first were getting your rescue center going. What were the early days like?
Okay, I'll be happy to, but I just thought maybe I should clarify one other thing, that the bushmeat trade, the way this is creating orphans, just to make that connection, is when a mother chimpanzee, when a poacher kills a mother chimpanzee and the baby, the clinging infant, survives the hunt, they can be worth more alive than dead, sold as pets or tourist attractions. And since we have been there and allowed the government to enforce its laws, you don't see chimps on chains and in cages in public establishments anymore. But people still keep them as pets in their compounds, and they're still smuggled out through Nigeria, up through North Africa, and into Asia. So it's still a big problem. But that's how the bushmeat trade has created these orphans. And we still get a lot of baby orphans, which is undeniable evidence that the bushmeat trade is thriving. And during those early days, it was, I didn't speak French at the time. I was, very unprepared as an American person to go into Cameroon and set up this sanctuary. But we, I really lived with a driver in the Embarge Forest. I lived in the village, for the first couple of months until, we were able to clear an area in the forest and set up some tents and build a latrine. And then my driver and I really lived, out in the forest, and, the two of us, with help from the local community, built the first enclosure and brought the first three chimpanzees there. We got stuck in the mud. We rented was trying to beat the rainy season when building the enclosure and didn't quite make it. And so the roads were already closed to trucks. And so we rented a van, a bush taxi, they call them. And we took out the seats and made room for these three cages and transported the three chimps for 18 hours and got stuck in the mud. And but we arrived there with them. And then from that point, when I had those first three, there was no turning back. I gradually learned to speak French, and we brought more and more chimps. And now we work with, in addition to the local staff that I mentioned, we work with volunteers from around the world. I like to have at least two or three there at one time. And we've had them from many, many countries. And so people who are interested in volunteering, I would be welcome to have, their applications would be welcome, but we do require a commitment of 6 months. And our program is a bit different than a lot of volunteer programs that require people to pay a lot. They pay, and then they can go and stay for a month or two, and they have very little responsibility. Ours is different in that you have to get yourself there, but once you're there, you don't have expenses. You live in our camp, and we provide the food. But you really work hard for the 6 months that you're there, and you have, an amazing opportunity to come to know chimpanzees, and there are few opportunities like that in the world.
So what are the facilities like at your rescue center for chimpanzees?
Well, we have these enclosure complexes that include big cages where they sleep at night, but each of the cages are connected to these forested enclosures where we've encircled tracts of forest with electric fencing. And it is natural habitat. We have a free living chimpanzee population. We have 225 acres, and we have free living chimpanzees who come around. We see them all the time. I didn't mean to habituate them, but it's what's happened. They let us see them all the time, and we hear them all the time. The chimpanzees, we do provision for them four times a day, but they do eat a lot out in the forest as well. But we beat the drum. We have a big plastic container, and we beat it with a stick, and it makes a big noise. And we beat the drum at the end of the day. They're used to sleeping inside, so they come in at night, and we hand feed. We know, of course, we know every chimpanzee. We see them every day. If somebody's not eating well, we know it right off. And then in the morning, we give them breakfast. They go outside, and then at 11 o'clock, we beat the drum. They come in, and usually they just take their food and go back to the forest, and then we do it again at 2 o'clock. I don't think anywhere in the world captive chimpanzees live better than they do at our sanctuary. So I'm very proud of that. The human facilities are very rustic. We have a camp with the electric enclosures that encircle the forest. We have solar panels that supply that electricity, but we don't really have enough to supply the camp. So there's no electricity in the camp. We have enough to charge our flashlights, but that's about it. And there's a pit latrine, and we have a barrel that's the shower, or people take bucket baths, and basically they have candlelight and torches at night, and it's very basic.
How long do chimpanzees live? How big are chimpanzees for
people don't know?
They, in the wild, the average is about 45 years for free-living chimpanzees. But in captivity, in a good form of captivity, where they have medical care and, you know, specialized, we make sure they have enough to eat and all that, they can live to be 55, 60 years and even older. And they are, a male chimpanzee can be 60, 65 kilograms. So, I'm so used to thinking in kilograms, I forget the poundage, but, you know, 135 pounds. And females are less than that, about 100 pounds or so.
So size of a smaller human?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And a lot of our males are bigger than me.
And they're fairly strong, too.
Oh, so. Well, see, that's the thing. Their size is not that, it doesn't sound that big, but they're so strong. They're 5 to 10 times stronger than a strong adult male human and way stronger than me. So they are just, they're really muscular. They're short and very muscular, and their bones are denser. So they're just amazing animals. They have, they're so similar to humans. They have, where I think human beings, I think, have the best there is on the planet. We have capacity for compassion and love that's just amazing. We also have the worst that there is on the planet, where we can be incredibly cruel and commit horrible atrocities. And chimpanzees have a similar range of behavior. And they're certainly, what they've taught me is that the capacity to love is not exclusively human. They have that capacity, and they can also be very cruel. And I've just learned so much from working with them.
Talk about some of the chimps you've worked with. You've been doing this for so long that I have to imagine a lot of the chimps you have at your rescue center have been with you since day one?
Some of them have been with me a very long time. The book I wrote, Kindred Beings, is especially about the first five. And there were some others that we were taking in those early days. But when I wrote the book, I really thought it was important to be able to develop the individual personalities and to let people know them the way I knew them. And so I really focused on these five. But soon after, I brought the first ones, we started getting babies, which I hadn't really intended to take babies, but again, I didn't understand the scope of the problem, and so it was necessary to take babies. And so some of those babies that I took in the early days are now big adults now, you know, at this point. And so I have strong relationships with those babies that I raised in the beginning. But the chimpanzees who I wrote about, who seem to really touch people are Dorothy and Nama. And they had been on chains at a hotel. They were chained at the entrance of a hotel. Dorothy had been there for 40 years, and Nama had been there for 16 years. And that was, the people who owned that place were not open to letting us take them. So that was a real struggle. And they were a powerful family. And I didn't think we had any chance of taking them by force. And so we really spent a lot of time trying to convince them to agree to let us take Dorothy and Nama. Ultimately, they didn't. And the government did step in. And we went in. There were, in addition to Dorothy and Nama, they had 8 monkeys there as well. And so we went in with a military police, a caravan of 7 cars and 7 armed military police, and forcefully confiscated them, finally. And at the sanctuary, Dorothy and Nama, they, in the early days, they cemented. They'd been able to see each other for years, but they couldn't touch. And so at the sanctuary, they were able to touch and hug and groom, you know, that most important chimpanzee social behavior, whereby political alliances are formed and lifelong friendships are established. And so they cemented their friendship. And Nama just thrived from the beginning. She was a very strong, she was small, much a very small adult female, but just with a lion heart. And she became the alpha female and formed an alliance with she actually chose the male who was going to be the alpha of the group and supported him unwaveringly, and the two of them really established order and kept the peace in a social group that we eventually expanded to 26 chimpanzees, and we were able to introduce baby after baby into their group, knowing that the two of them would make sure that no harm came to the baby. So it was really just a remarkable era in my life to watch that unfold. Dorothy had a very difficult time at the sanctuary. She, after 40 years, she was physically frail, socially awkward, and had absolutely no self-confidence. And so she was an easy target for bullies. And Nama protected her. She kept her safe for 2 years until Dorothy ultimately did find her own strength. And there was this event in Dorothy's life that allowed her to become strong. And I don't want to tell everything in the book, so I'm not going to tell people about that event. But it was really, but before Dorothy died in 2008, she had gained respect and love in the group. And it was actually a photograph of her funeral. There was, as I wheeled her, my caregiver and I wheeled her body past the enclosure, so over 20-acre enclosure where she had lived with 25 other chimpanzees. As we wheeled the wheelbarrow past, they heard the wheelbarrow coming, and everybody came out of the forest, and they lined up at the fence line. And so I pulled the wheelbarrow up in front of the fence line and stopped. And one of our volunteers who had been in our funeral procession, she snapped a photograph that showed the chimpanzees. It was a very obvious expression of non-human grief. And that photograph was published in National Geographic in a double page spread, and it went viral and was really published all over the world, and I was interviewed many times. And that's how the book came about, because a literary agent on Madison Avenue in New York tracked me down in Africa, said she was touched by the photograph, and if I ever wanted to write a book, that she would be willing to represent me. And when I saw that human reaction to this photograph, I thought it was a story that people would relate to, and that it was important to tell the story. And so that's when I wrote the book.
Is that a common thing that you do, like you did for Dorothy, is have a funeral for the animals when they die?
Well, we haven't had a lot of them die, fortunately, but when we have, I do allow the chimps to see them, and that wasn't the first time I had seen grief in the chimps, and so I wasn't surprised by that at all. And that's what the journalist always asked me, were you surprised by the reaction of the chimps? And I honestly answered, no, I wasn't surprised at all, but what did surprise me was the human reaction to the photograph, ultimately. And what Dorothy's situation, it was very, I had just left the sanctuary when she died, and I was in the city, and the volunteers called me and said that they didn't think Dorothy was breathing. She had eaten at 2 o'clock, and at 4 o'clock, she lay down on the grass at the edge of the forest and died. And I got on the train and rushed back and got on the train at 6 o'clock and arrived back in the camp sometime after midnight, and about 3 o'clock. And I sat with Dorothy's body in the clinic, and I knew that I was going to have to perform an autopsy. We had to know why she died, and there was nobody else to do it. And so at first light, I started the autopsy and, really tried to forget that it was the lungs and the heart and the intestines of somebody I loved. But as I was doing the autopsy, we had walkie-talkies by that time, and the front gate, which was it's over a half a kilometer from where I was working in the veterinary clinic, but the gate man kept calling and saying that people were at the gate. And normally when people come, it's because they're sick. We provide a lot of medical care in the community, and I thought that people were coming and they were sick, and it's the last thing I wanted to do at that point. And then there's so many, I kept thinking, oh my gosh, is there an epidemic in the village? And finally, when I finished the autopsy, I called the gate man and said, who is at the gate? And he said, the population. And it took me about 2 seconds to realize that people had heard the evening before that Dorothy died, and without being invited, they had walked up from kilometers away to pay respects to Dorothy. And so we had a small funeral for the human community for Dorothy, and then afterwards we left them and went to bury her beside the enclosure, and that's when the chimpanzees came out.
So you have regular interactions with the neighboring people who live around your rescue center.
Yes, we do. We've really impacted the community to a huge extent, which is how we've managed to get support for our mission. When I went there, they had never even seen a white woman before. They had seen the white loggers, but had never seen a white woman. From the beginning, my agreement with them is that we would buy the fruit for the chimpanzees from their community, from their villages, and that we would provide jobs. And we provided jobs and training for people who had never worked before. And we go into 73 chimpanzees eat a lot, and we feed our staff as well. And so we go into the villages three times a week, and there's seven villages, and we come back with truckloads of produce. And so we created a market economy in the village where none existed, and they grow these fruits and vegetables specifically for us. And we also provide a lot of medical care in the community. We built a school, and we pay through with a grant from the Dutch embassy. We built a school, and we pay the salaries of the three teachers there. And we, with a grant from the United States embassy, we just installed a grain mill in another village, which has really helped their economy and also, you know, improve their nutrition. So we, in that small community, because they've seen their lives improve with our being there, they're really receptive to our mission. And they, there was no way that we could go into that community, as impoverished as it was, where people don't have electricity, they don't have running water, they live in stick and mud houses with dirt floors, and devote all our resources to saving the lives of chimpanzees and watch our neighbor's children die. You know, expect them to receive us well when we didn't really do something to improve their lives. So it was necessary.
Who were the other three chimps that you featured in your book?
Jackie, Peppy, and Becky. And then ultimately I did bring in some others who came into their social world. There were other chimpanzees who eventually came into the story. But it was those five that were the beginning.
Do you have any vet schools or universities or whatever that work with you to get experience for their veterinarians?
Well, we haven't. And, you know, the thing is, well, that's not true. Now, I have collaborated with the university in France, and we've taken a couple of students from France before. But it's not so helpful for us. You know, what I need is veterinarians who have some experience to come in, and they don't have to have chimpanzee experience or even monkey experience. If they have some good surgical experience with dogs and cats, a lot of that is transferable. And I have our veterinary technician on the ground who knows how to work with the chimpanzees. He knows how to administer anesthesia, as does my manager, who's been there for so many years working with me. So it's really the veterinarians who need that surgical, kind of technical skill that my people on the ground there don't have. Those are who we need. I like to help veterinary students, but, you know, we don't really have the capacity to do too much of that.
All right. So how can people find out more about your rescue center and your organization?
Well, read my book, Kindred Beings, What 73 Chimpanzees Taught Me About Life, Love, and Connection, published by HarperCollins and available since September 10th. It's available at the bookstores and through all the online booksellers. We'll give you a very good window into what we do. Also, visit our website, www.ida-africa.org.
Very good. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Again, we've just been talking with Dr. Sherry Speed. She is author of the new book, Kindred Beings, What 73 Chimpanzees Taught Me About Life, Love, and Connection. And you can find out more about her work via their website, ida-africa.org.